Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. We're joined now by poet, playwright and novelist Dermot Bulger, who's here to talk about his 15th novel, Hideaway, a story set behind the walls of Grange Gorman in the 1940s that deals with Ireland's past, secrets and the ghosts of history that stalk our lives. Dermot, thanks so much for coming in to us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. At my age, it's a pleasure to be anywhere.
Well, very happy Sunday to you. And the book is beautifully written, like all that has preceded your incredible career, Dermot. I'm curious maybe to start with Grange Gorman. Obviously, that creates certain connotations for people maybe of a certain age in terms of the site of a psychiatric hospital. Maybe our newer generations will know it today more as a university campus. But you are going back in time to that high-walled place with all of the history and controversy that came with it. And I'm curious, why Grange Gorman? Why go back to that part of our history?
Well, my sole experience with Grange Gorman was that when Ivor Brown was chief medical officer, he did these experimental workshops, and I had a state-registered nurse administer a high dosage of hallucinogenic drugs into my left buttock one weekend so that I could have an out-of-body experience. And when they peeled me down off the ceiling, I realised that I should do something like scuba diving instead, because it wasn't fun. But I visited patients there, people who had nervous breakdowns and things, and it was a terrifying place to go into, because it was originally built in the 1814 as the Richmond Lunatic Asylum, and then it changed names and it changed, but it was a huge place. And when my novel is set in the 40s, it had 2,000 souls crammed in there, and so it was, you could hear the roars from Dalymount Park if you're a patient there, but yet it was as if it was invisible. The people moved around it. It's only now that the walls are down that you really realise just how big it was. You can see the true footprint of it. And I was, what really fascinated me, I mean, I had a neighbour who worked there, so it was always in the background of my life. But there was an artist called Alan Cunahan who had a wonderful exhibition. And when the asylum, the psychiatric hospital closed, a lot of the records were taken away, but in the attics there were all these personal possessions were left behind, people's handbags and things.
Yeah, and you have a photograph on the front, which is really poignant.
That's by Alan Cunahan, and this wonderful exhibition comprising of the handbags, the rosary beads, the miraculous medals, the letters, the photographs of the people. And it was so, to walk into that exhibition was just terrifying and moving and profound. And I saw that maybe 10, 12 years ago, but it actually stayed with me, and I sort of knew that one day I would have to write about Grange Gorman, because it was an uncomfortable place. And I think that sometimes, particularly during COVID, to a sense that poets and writers should be bringers of comfort, and I think they should be bringers of discomfort as well.
And the picture from that on the front page of the cover of the book, the little tag on the possessions, it's 14 spoons, 2 prayer books, 2 rosary beads. And like, in terms of who went inside Grange Gorman, like, it ranged from people, of course, who were severely ill, people who had conditions like maybe epilepsy, but there was also then just the unmarried women at the time.
At the turn of the 20th century, because Grange Gorman was the first of these hospitals, but then they sprang all over Ireland, Ballinasloe and all these places, and in 1900, one in every 200 Irish people was living in an asylum, and the women were put in for things like domestic disagreements, bad treatment by relatives, jealousy, pride, and basically what they put in for. In a lot of cases, there was an unmarried sister who was in the way. This happens in Hideaway, and basically there was nowhere else to put her, and so it was where we locked away many of our secrets.
And very easy to put people who might have been ill or had psychiatric problems, but as you say, maybe just women who were quote unquote in the way of maybe a brother or a son taking over the farm.
Women who were odd, or women who had outrages committed against them, as was the expression at the time, and they didn't want to speak.
So
they didn't want them to speak about it, you know?
And very easy to be put in there, but very, very hard to be removed, to have yourself withdrawn from an institution like that.
Well, you needed to have, you needed to be well enough, to be deemed well enough, but also you needed to have a relative who would be willing to sign a document to actually, you know, to take care of you. And a lot of relatives didn't. I mean, not only did a lot of handbags wind up in those attics, but like a lot of, they did unclaimed, but many bodies were unclaimed as well.
But you talk about being able to prove that you were quote unquote well enough, but at this time we didn't have a language around mental health and wellness. Is that, when you reflect back on it, was that we didn't have this shared language between us to really describe truthfully what was maybe going on with people at that time?
I think we didn't have that shared language, because even one of the other things in the book we talk about later is like trauma from conflict, but post-traumatic stress wasn't really an understood term until the Vietnam War. So you actually have, so even to that thing. So there was a lot of, I mean, nowadays a lot of young people have various conditions. And those conditions help us to understand whatever dilemmas they're going through. And the terminology for that didn't exist in those days, and the patience for it didn't exist for that. When you had people beaten for being left-handed, when you had no understanding of dyslexia, when you had no understanding of all these things that now are very ordinary things, you actually have a situation where anybody who didn't conform to a certain example of what somebody should be was regarded as somehow unbalanced or unhinged, and that would might bring disgrace for family. It might be as bad as having TB in a family to have somebody who was regarded as, and they were locked away.
So there's the question of genuine health issues, but then what you're touching on is the question of respectability in Ireland at this time. But the other one then is the hold of religion of the Catholic Church at that time. And I wonder how much of that you came to understand through writing this book, and maybe even your own learnings through the experiences of your father growing up.
Well, funnily enough, the asylums in Ireland were the one part of public life that the Catholic Church didn't involve itself in. It was, I think that the actual, as Professor Brendan Kelly in a book on Grange Garman said, he felt that maybe the Church felt that the those who were mentally ill, as the term was at the time, were not among the deserving poor. And so it was one of the few things where the Church had no involvement whatsoever. They had involvement in every other aspect of Irish life. I do think people say that the Catholic Church ruled a lot of the mindset of 20th century Ireland, and that was true. But I think the cult of respectability was also there, and the cult of actually making sure that your neighbour didn't know that you had problems. And this was true of small town Wexford, and it was true of Ballyfermot as they were growing suburbs of Finglas and things else. And also, I remember writing a book called The Woman's Daughter years ago about somebody who locked up her daughter in Finglas. And the same week I published it, it turned out that two cousins of Queen Elizabeth, the late Queen Elizabeth, had been locked away after the Second World War, and they had been written out of all the record books as dead, but they'd actually been 40 years. Actually, there's an episode of The Crown deals with them years later, you know. And so this cult of respectability wasn't confined to any particular class or creed. It was a sense of keeping up appearances.
So the Church might not have been directly involved in places like Grange Garman, but the respectability, the mindset, and you saw that with your own dad, isn't that correct, in terms of him and his own school dealings with the Christian Brothers and seeing how there was maybe these unwritten rules?
Oh yes, sorry, I'm having to delve in memory. My father was a sailor who sailed in the Second World War, and those tiny Irish ships being bombed with equal neutrality by the Germans and the British. No, but I think what you're referring to, well, I remember my father was that. There's a guy in the novel of Hideaway called Gus, who's like, and he's a working class man, and his weapons are subterfuge and silence. And I think my father's generation were like that. They knew a lot, but they didn't say a lot. And one day, I brought my father up the Irish Times every Saturday morning, and he would say, "That bousy Fintan O'Toole, hear that bousy Fintan O'Toole gone about the Christian Brothers." And I said, "Well, you know, Fintan has a point there, you know." He says, "Nah, he's out of bousy." And then he told me a story that was far worse than anything that Fintan had actually had in the article.
And for the avoidance of doubt, we will say Fintan O'Toole is a brilliant.
When he was a small boy, my father, he was very quiet, always a very quiet man. And like a Christian brother walking behind him had a letter and just hit him around 10 or 15 times on his back, leaving welts and wheals. And he never said a word to his mother, but when he was, his mother was passing him and just touched his back, and he jumped. And she took off his shirt, and it was all, you know, his whole body was bruised. And she went to a man who was the local Garda sergeant, and they were going to do this, they were going to do that. And of course, they did nothing. They couldn't do anything. What was interesting was that this same Christian brother was fond of, you know, Doing things I shouldn't do. And he did it to one of the Corish children. The Corish were now this is going back in the 1920s. The Corish children were the Corish family. And of course, he stepped over a line then because he'd done something important and he disappeared to Africa or somewhere.
But I'd say your father's mother was unusual at the time of realising this and having the gumption and asserting herself to go and lodge the complaint. But when you don't have a written set of rules of engagement, nothing came to pass.
Yeah, I mean, she was I think, a normal mother's instincts to protect her child and outrage at her child being assaulted in this manner. But at the same time, there was no way out. There was no way to actually, there was no comeback against these people. And that was the minds, and that was the reality in Ireland for a long time. And people say, why did things happen? But things happened because there wasn't a way to avoid them happening.
And hence the book title, mm-hmm. Hideaway, because these secrets, even when they were brought forward, they often disappeared into silence, into the unknown and unknowable. Do you think we've gotten better, though, through the decades and years of trying to unlock those secrets, talk about them out loud, in the open, transparently?
I think we have. I think every generation throws up its own secrets. But I think that as a society, Ireland is, despite its many problems, Ireland is an awful lot healthier than it was in the, and people go on about the old days, but the old days were actually truly, truly grim if you think about them. People say nothing happened, but that's because people couldn't speak about what was happening to them. And I think that there now is an ability to speak. And I mean, actually, ironically, looking back on my time, radio was a huge thing. I mean, Liveline, when Marion Finucane ran it a long time ago, and even up to Joe Duffy now, I mean, suddenly you had this forum where people could actually speak. And I remember, like, back in the 90s, unmarried mothers, as they were called, who had to give up their children, like, coming and speaking with extraordinary elegance because they had waited like 20, 30 years to tell their stories. And I remember like just sitting in front of a radio and saying, if I wrote this, people wouldn't believe it is so articulate. And because people have their own story locked in their soul and very often they have no chance to say it. And many people died before they had the chance to actually speak.
All of this has required you to go a little bit deeper looking at the events of the Civil War, but without maybe trying to kind of relitigate the ins and outs and the divisiveness of that debate sometimes, but you instead have been kind of trying to understand the trauma, the legacy, the psyche of that. Like, what have been your learnings there? And as you've kind of gone into the atlas of the Civil War and the treatment of women, you mentioned there earlier, I think the phrase was, yeah, that the women who had been outraged.
Yeah, there's a wonderful atlas of Civil War just published recently by Cork University Press, and there's, I think, one chapter on sexual violence to women, and it goes into great detail of Anne Ellen Mary Biggs in Tipperary, who was her house broken into, and she was outraged 8 or 9 times, which means sexually assaulted by 3 drunken anti-treaty volunteers who ransacked her house, and they are now commemorated on a monument in Tullis, and she moved to Dublin, but she wound up in a psychiatric hospital, and she's an unmarked grave with her sister in Mount Jerome. And this sort of but that time of chaos, it wasn't just on one side because there were 3 National Army officers as well.
Ended up with statues. She who was attacked ended up in an unmarked grave.
Yeah, because there is a certain rewriting of with over time, violence becomes sanitized. And I always think that those stories, the untold stories, are what, for the last 40 years as a novelist, I've always been attracted to those untold stories.
And so what do you think happened there? Was it that we told these myths and legends and we built people through the years into heroes?
I think that there's a certain fetish around the Easter Rising, and quite right, so, because it is a very honourable thing and people understand it. But also you had people like, James Connolly had enormous respect for George Mary Plunkett and vice versa, but they had totally different political opinions. And if somehow the Easter Rising had survived and they had formed a country, one would have had to shot the other. There was always that thing that you actually have. Todd Andrews talks about when he was a young volunteer, he rarely taught. He was just fueled by enthusiasm and energy. And the Civil War was when people suddenly had to think. And finally, when a ballot was no longer a sufficient blueprint for a country. And I think that everybody, when I look back at that time, everybody was so young. They're impossibly young. Even Collins was very, very young. And they're also They had, I think when you're young, you see the world in a very black and white manner, and you can commit very violent acts and that you don't really understand the ramifications of. And so Hideaway in some way is about the actual, that if you fire a shot, the ramifications, the echo of that shot will live with you for the rest of your life. And sometimes these men became very successful politicians and businessmen, and sometimes they wound up in places like Grange Garman, haunted by what they did and haunted by ghosts and voices in their head.
And in present day, so you've better understood the context of that moment, the traumas, the psyches, and then you look at our current generations and maybe how we think about our history, how we perceive our history. Do you think there's any disconnect between the history as then and how we interpret it now? Maybe when it comes to some of our songs, our poetry.
I think there's always a disconnect, not only in Ireland, but in most countries, between, I think that the John Milton Singh in the play by the Western World did capture it very, very well. Yeah, a man comes in to a little, to Peggy in a little pub, and he tells about killing his father with a lie in some distant place, and he's a hero and he's actually worshipped. And then when the father catches up with him and he tries to kill the father again, they try to hang him, because violence in front of your eyes is so different from romanticised violence elsewhere. And I think that my generation had that about the War of Independence and the Easter Rising, and the Civil War wasn't ever really spoken about. And I think that probably with the Northern Troubles being 30 years old, there is that sort of romanticising of it as well, or that, maybe romanticising, but of a softening of the horror of the Enniskillen bombing, and Mary Wilson, that wonderfully brave nurse, consoling her father as she lay dying, as she knew she lay dying, and so many other people who were victims of those times. And I think that gets washed away, and I think that probably isn't only true of Ireland, it's true of all countries, that they begin to mythologise their past.
And because it can get, to use your own words, washed away through the decades and the retelling of stories and these myths and legends and heroes, is that the very awkward job of a writer, is to push yourself outside the comfort zone and try to tell the truths of that history as you see it?
I think the job of a writer is to reveal the past, and is to, and sometimes hold up a mirror to a country that the country may not actually like. And I think though there are trigger warnings and everything else, but I think that to scandalise and blaspheme occasionally, as Pasolini said, is one of the roles of a writer. And I think that you should always look at your past with a cost, and that is not to condemn anybody, and nobody in the Hideaway is shaped around various real people who did wound up in Grange Garman, but none of it is judging them, it's trying to understand them. It's so easy to say so-and-so was bad, so-and-so was good. But I think they all started off good, and I think that the circumstances twisted them. And there's an extraordinary moment that I came across that's walked into the book, and it's actually not long after Bloody Sunday, and five members of Collins' squad go to Portrane to a nurses, to a dance, because Portrane's a handy place to be away from Dublin, and they begin to drink and they go totally insane, and they have to be locked into a padded cell, and they're slashing the padded cell with their knives. And Michael Lynch, who was a commander of the IRA, writes to HQ and said, I mean, these men, this was pure madness, and it was, they're obviously so traumatised that by this pressure and the strain they're living under, imagining not only committing these acts, but knowing that any moment you could be captured and tortured, and the things that happened to Dick McKee in Dublin Castle were terrible. And so the strain of that, I think, just drove these men into doing things that in later life they could never defend.
With a novel like this, Hideaway, it feels like a little bit of your sense making, you're turning on the lights on our history. But you've said, this is the last one. You said this is the last novel I'm doing, is it? And why?
When I was young, at the age of 12, I dreamt of the Nobel Prize, and then in later years, I dreamt of the Booker Prize, and now I'm at an age where I can see this glistening prize on the horizons, and it's called a free travel pass. and I get it in February.
Congratulations.
It's 50 years since my first poem was published. I'm only 65, but at 15, I was being published in the national newspapers. When I was 16, 49 years ago, my great friend Paul Dawkin was urging me on stage in the Player Wills Theatre to give my first public reading at the launch of some anthology we were both in. And so for that 50 years, every day I've got up and thought about writing, and I have managed to raise, I stopped working at the age of 24, and I've managed to raise a family on the thin sliver of my imagination. And I think there comes a time when you say, I've told all the stories. Now, the thing is that as a writer, you get ambushed by stories and you get ambushed by voices. But at the moment, if I walk out of the Archie Studios and I'm run over by a 46A on the road outside, there's no story that I felt I haven't told. I felt this, dealing with the Civil War and dealing with Grange Garman, were these two areas of Irish life that I'd never explored and I wanted to explore. So I suspect that I would be sitting quietly in Griffith Park in Dunkondra writing a poem, and I'd be mugged by a novel in 2 years' time. But at the moment, I just feel I have this. It's 15 novels. I have a new play opening next week. It was my 18th play. I've written 11 books of poetry, and maybe the world is saying to me, Dermot, please shut up.
Or maybe it's just that there's a little bit of a letting go moment, that this sense making you've taken your responsibility seriously, and that you can find the joy hopefully in the writing now, but also hopefully support the next generation that needs to come through as well. Is that something you think
about?
Well,
I've been involved in New Irish writing with Kieran Carty for 3 decades, and it's amazing to see those writers come. And it's amazing. I remember reading the first short story by Mike McCormick. And in manuscript form, and the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and it's still that great discovery in finding a new writer. And once I began as a publisher, as a factory hand at the age of 18 in Finglas, and you never stop being a small publisher. You're always saying, oh, there's a wonderful book there. So, but I do think there's a time of letting go and actually saying, well, that because it is, a writer is like an athlete, that you have one drink at night, you don't have two because you have a hangover in the morning, you want to be clear. And so maybe there's a time you say, I just need to sit back and reflect, you know. But I think Irish writing is a much healthier place than it was when I began. And because I saw, you know, when I began, I had heroes, you know, these writers, like wonderful poets, and I saw the terrible poverty they lived in. And the terrible, you know, the terrible conditions that they worked in. And I think that has changed, and changed for the better.
And it feels like the Irish football team maybe have been heroes to you, because you've tried to kind of, through the three plays and the latest one being Home, Boys, Home, to try and tell the story of how Ireland has changed and evolved and become more diverse, but through the telling of these plays and stories.
My mother was from a family of 11 in Aniela, in Listnagunshan, in Aniela in Monaghan. My father from a family of 7. And they all emigrated. They all had to emigrate, apart from the uncle who got the farm, the uncle who got the house in Wexford. My father, who was a sailor, who emigrated for 44 years, twice a week. And so I have cousins. I have wonderful cousins in Dublin, and my own family have all stayed in Dublin. But I have far more cousins and far more relations with Liverpool and Luton and Coventry and Wolverhampton accents. And I remember being at Euro 88, and I realised that, and finding so many second, third generation Irish people on those terraces along with Irish people, and that team out there seemed to represent a broader definition of Ireland that included all my extended family. I think that, and that was what In High Germany became about when I did it in the Gaiety Theatre in 1980, and there was a second play at Patton Glass. And now this new play in Home, Boys, Home, which is in the Civic and then goes to transfers to the Viking Theatre in Clontarf, it is about, suddenly I see the representation of a new Ireland in that football team, in those lads like O'Benny and Gavin Bazuna, who were born in Tala, or who's even born in Africa and has chosen to play for Ireland. And in a way that you don't see that represented in Dáil Éireann, you do see that diversity represented in that football team. Unfortunately, in the old days, like in High Germany was at Euro 88, and the Patton Glass was when the Thierry Henry's cheating hand robbed Ireland of great glory. And this game ends at an under 16s Irish soccer match, because there hasn't been a big match to hang it on for 20 years, because sadly I go to Ireland matches, and the bit that's best is the bit at the beginning when my Michael D comes on and everybody cheers, and it's still downhill from there, unfortunately.
You have also written about your wife, Bernie, passing 14 years ago, beautifully in poetry. You've now, though, found love and happiness again. I believe you're going to get
found
married.
I found a very late and wonderful benediction in my life. Oh. And her name is Helen. And and it was, and we get married next year. And so that would be a new start, you know. And so it is a wonderful blessing. And she's a very wonderful person. And I feel very blessed.
Oh, I can hear it and see it. And it's lovely all these 14 years later that you have found that moment and the benediction. Are you optimistic? Like, you've found this moment, you've happiness personally, you're letting go of some of those ghosts in the writing. Hopefully you'll find more joy in it. When you look around at working class communities, the parts of Dublin that you know so well, is there hope? Is there optimism?
There's always hope, because I have great faith in new generations, and I have great faith. I came from a punk generation where basically if you had a guitar and if you had a mate who owned a bass guitar and could wink, you actually had a band. And there was that sense of you know, Raven Arts Press began at the same time as in Dublin and Hop Press, and so the Irish Writers Corps, and people were just starting things. And I think that every generation finds a new way to express themselves, and every generation finds, I mean, I never claim to speak for anybody by myself, and I don't speak for the thingness I come from now, but there are new writers, there are new musicians, there are new filmmakers, and those possibilities that when I was young it seemed impossible that anybody could make a living as a writer. There were almost no filmmakers in Ireland, or they're making like 20-minute short films, and there were almost no musicians who were making an impact. It was Phil Lynott was there, and the wonder of Phil Lynott. But, you know, that has changed, and there's generations coming up with great, great confidence, and I bless them, and I'm amazed by them, and I wish them every success.
Well, we wish you all the happiness in the world with your marriage next year, and on the publication now of Hideaway, that is published by New Island and is out now. And your plays, Home, Boys Home, will be at the Civic Theatre as part of Dublin Theatre Festival from Tuesday, October 1 to Saturday, 12th of October, and will transfer then to Viking Theatre, Clontarf, Monday 14 to Saturday the 20th of October. We wish you extraordinary happiness and joy in all that comes next, Dermot Bulger.
Anya, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.